This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Chase Thomas podcast. The Chase Thomas podcast. My nephew needs me to record. See, I already hate it.
All right, we're back here on the Chase Thomas podcast. From still the aforementioned Chase Thomas, coming to you live from Knoxville, Tennessee. Everything School HQ, sipping his Tennessee Smokies mug because it is Smoky season once again here in East Tennessee. Eric Kane of Locked On Vols and VolQuest. Eric, good afternoon, sir. How are you?
Yeah, good afternoon. Doing well, man. Hope you are.
It's birthday day. It's a good
happy
time.
Happy birthday. I didn't know if you wanted to bring it on the show, but yes, happy birthday.
Thank you. Yeah, no, it's like we talked about, for the good folks in their 30s, I think they can attest. The best thing, and this can be like kind of weed its way into our on air, the reason I like my 30s so much more than my 20s is your 30s, people, like, I don't get invited to as many things. I don't feel like I have to go out and do as many things. I don't have to experience, like, I am just, it, I know who I am. Like, you and I, we work a lot. I think we're probably two of the most busy, like, Ball media people in Knoxville, with what we do day in, day out, but that's okay. Like, it's just that people assume that's what you're doing in your 30s. Like, you're working a lot, you're a family guy, we're married, we're kind of off the radar. We are who we are. Like, it's just so nice to just be like, I know exactly who I am. Like, yeah. There's not gonna be much change for us between like 31 and 32, 33, and then 38. Like, this is kind of the deal. Like, this is kind of who we signed up. This is gonna be basically who we are from here on out.
I feel it, man. I like it. I'm a little bit different than I was about 10 years ago, that's for sure. But having the wife, having the job, yeah, having some friends, having the dog, it's good enough for me. So I feel that for sure on many levels.
Oh, yeah. And like the getting married, like my wife and I talk about it all the time. Like, I don't know if it was like this for you, but I mean, I'm grateful that I met her when I did, because I'm nearly 30. Like, I kind of am who I am. I've always been like raised an eyebrow when you go, because you talked about it. Were you like a different person 10 years ago in your early 20s? When you meet the right person younger in your younger days, you're rolling the dice on who they're going to be 10 years later and who you're going to be 10 years later. So I was always like one of those. I'm going to wait until I figured a lot of stuff out before I get on that road. And my wife and I both being in our 30s is great, because we know who we are, and there's not gonna be a whole lot of surprises on who we are the rest
of the
way.
Look at us now. Yeah.
I love it. Well, Eric, we have some Tennessee sports to talk about here. One of the things that I want to start off with, orange and white game over the weekend. It was a lot of fun. Obviously not shown a lot, and people are making a whole lot of what Lane Kiffin and company was doing, but I was listening to Cole Kublik, his Cube show this morning, which is really good, because I just love learning stuff from him. He's just so insightful, and obviously played the game at Auburn and all that, but I like listening to that one when I want to learn some more insight in terms of what schemes people are running. He's talking about Bama, and he ended up talking about Ole Miss spring game and the reaction to it. And one of the things I thought was interesting, and I wonder from your perspective, do you think it would behoove Tennessee going forward to try and do some of what Ole Miss did? And his thinking being, and I think McElroy talked about it too, was that like, they don't want to show any who their number two guys are or flash anybody. So if you turn into like this little hot dog eating circus type deal, teams can't poach you because they don't know who's doing well, who had a good spring, who you're going to count on more in the fall. Like, I'm sure part of Tennessee was like, man, we have a lot of receivers who kind of popped here. And so there's some tape of Chaz Nimrod with a touchdown, Chris Brazel obviously playing really well, Dante Thornton and Mike Matthews obviously showing up. So the depth of Tennessee's wide receiver room stood out, I think, in this game. And you kind of wonder if, like, I understand, like, I think that's an overlooked part. And I wonder if you agree with it, that like, that's maybe the new way to go about it, is you want to hide as many guys you can. And by doing something weird, you can do that.
You know, everything's changing, and you know, the greats will adapt to that change and then thrive with that change. And so I am curious, and I've talked about this on my, you know, hit on the radio show with Tyler and Will every Wednesday. You know, what will spring games look like 10 years from now, 5 years from now? And, you know, I remember back when Butch Jones was here and he had the loudspeaker and they were doing contests and one-on-ones and everything. And that's kind of a unique spin on it and everything. Kind of got that vibe from Ole Miss this year, except it was much cooler because there was a dunk contest. There was a hot dog eating contest. I will say this. I doubt very seriously Josh Heupel would ever want to broadcast a dunk contest because he would not want anybody to get hurt. When Joe Milton had that orange throw before the Orange Bowl last year, I know there was a lot of people that weren't happy about that.
Yeah.
But it's intriguing to think about because all coaches think, Tennessee's coaches very much so, but certainly not alone, that they've reinvented the wheel, that their play concepts and their designs and everything, it's never been done before. I mean, newsflash, football's been around a long time. Okay. Mm-hmm. So you can put a different spin on it for sure. But the speed option's been there forever. And so, like, but I mean, all coaches are like that. They don't want to show anything. So, yeah, I think you're onto something. I mean, I'll be intrigued. And with the second transfer portal window open, I bet this time next year, this SEC clause of not being able to go in the second window from one SEC team to another, I bet that'll be a thing of the past. And let's not act like tampering's not a thing.
Yeah.
There are people on Tennessee's program right now who are not in the transfer portal and on Ole Miss and Alabama and Iowa and every other team in the nation who were getting contacted through back channels saying, well, hey, man, if you want into that portal, we got a little spot for you. That's what we can do for you right here. So maybe hiding some of that, because you're right, like Chaz Nimrod and Caleb Webb, the back end of the conversation about Tennessee's wide receivers this spring, Tennessee wants to hang on to him for sure. But, you know, I'm just using those guys as an example. Like, the grass could be greener somewhere else, and you got to see a little bit of tape from the orange and white game. So I don't know. It'll be I agree with you. It'll be interesting to see kind of the way this navigates and how things change for Tennessee and if other teams go about it as well. I thought it was unique. I thought it was kind of cool what Ole Miss did. But at the end of the day, too, I was asked this earlier in the week. I mean, as a football fan, as a football guy, and as a media member, I'm glad that I at least got to see something, right?
Yeah.
And so I was appreciative of that, even though it was very vanilla and very simulated.
Yeah, and I just look at when you do the takeaways coming out of it, like the biggest, like something I was jotting down as I'm watching is just that, like, what are there going to be the positions of strength going into summer ball? Like, when you look at, obviously a lot of people were held out to be cautious, specifically on the offensive line. You want to be careful there, but, and I mean, running back too, but a lot of that's just, they probably would prefer to have more running backs play in this game than all said and done. But I just feel like, to me, and this is something that I've told family and friends who have been like all the Tennessee people in my life who've been kind of like, okay, what's this offense going to look like? What's because last year we kind of knew, Eric, that like it was the Jalen Wright show. Like, we knew early on that this was going to be a run first type of gambit, and this was going to be kind of a pivot from what Tennessee fans saw with Heupel and Hendon Hooker and the hype, just the high electric, you know, top 10 offense and just more fun. Like, it wasn't that it wasn't successful last year. It just wasn't as fun. You know, it's just more fun to throw the ball downfield and to have Jalen Hyatt catch 5 touchdown passes against your arch rival. That's just more fun and it's better TV. But you look at this year, I think to me, we're going to go way more in the 2022 direction. That's just something I had jotted down from the spring game and just who our options are and personnel wise that I don't think they really have a choice with the running back room being what it is at the moment. And I just think you have to play these guys and you're going to have to rotate more than you've ever had to at the receiver position. You can't do the 3-person guy and we're running like that. Just can't, like, that cannot be part of this deal this fall. Is that your biggest position of strength? Because that's what I had circled out on offense, that the receiver room is, because defensive line is obviously the answer here. There's just no, like, it's defensive line. But I think receiver is just freaking deep, man. And I am so curious how Heupel and Kelsey Pope handle these rotations, because they have suddenly a lot of dudes, if they're healthy, a lot of dudes that can play and really, really help this team.
Yeah, no doubt. Biggest strength on this team is 100% the defensive line. But if you're looking at offense, has some questions coming into spring practice about, well, you know, Brew's not going to be going through spring practice. Squirrel will be out there, but I mean, they should be limited with him. You're losing, you know, Ramel Keaton, who kind of had after a really strong 2022 filling in for Cedric Tillman, kind of had a bounce. He didn't have a great year, I guess. Still led Tennessee in touchdowns receiving wise. So I had questions about that. You know, Dante Thornton responded and you know, he was a guy that I thought like, okay, well, the second transfer portal window could, you know, Gerald Mincy left. Could Dante Thornton leave? Man, Dante Thornton had arguably the best spring of anybody on the roster.
Yeah.
He was phenomenal. And what a response, because you knew, I mean, I was a huge Dante Thornton advocate last year. Even when he was struggling, I was like, if he ever figures it out, dude's going to be in the NFL. I mean, he's got length, strength. He's got speed, route running, all that. He was just kind of playing out of position a little bit. And Tennessee saw all those intangibles at Oregon and said, okay, I want to put him in the slot because, newsflash, the slot is what makes this offense go.
Yeah.
And it just didn't work out. But, man, what a response by him. Chris Brazel, a little slow to get going because new system, new team, new quarterback. But he got stronger and stronger and stronger and stronger as spring practice went on. You feel really good about him. Mike Matthews, you saw why everybody was so high on him and how he was a coveted five-star. The adjustment he had to that gas and Moore. Good throw by Moore as well because it was an option route kind of stemming out there on the perimeter and threw it only to where his guy could get it, and what an adjustment he made. Braylon Staley burst on the scene. He's a guy that I think can truly allow Squirrel White to go get a drink of water, you know? Yeah. And then you still have Caleb Webb and Chaz Nimrod, who have played an SEC game. So, yeah, the wide receiver position, man, huge strength for me. Great spring. And I do think that they're going to have to open it up and play a little bit more, more so than they have in years past. And, you know, with Tennessee, they've always been a running football team. They've averaged over 200 yards. You know, Josh Hopple's averaged over 200 yards rushing a game since he's been here. But with the question marks behind Dylan Sampson, how many guys? Last year was a three-headed monster. This year, when everybody's healthy, Cam Sutton's not healthy right now. It should be a two-headed monster, but injuries play a factor into it as well. I think the explosiveness with Nico at quarterback, we're 10 minutes in, haven't even mentioned Nico.
Yeah.
With Nico at quarterback, who is capable, in my opinion, of making more of those plays, better decisions, and off-platform throws. I think it's going to, that was my biggest takeaway. The explosiveness looks like it's returned. And it might not be record-setting, 46 points a game, leading the nation in total offense, but it'll be much better than the 31 points per game you put up last year and kind of middle of the road in offense. And I think you're heading back in that right direction offensively.
I think so, too. And I think, for me, I like kind of how the depth chart's kind of organized itself in the wide receiver room, where you've got Dante, and he was talking about his relationship with Mike Matthews on TPL Tennessee, and I think he's clearly way more comfortable on the outside that you talked about. Like, this is just where he wants to be. He's healthy. And I also just think we've seen, like, Jalin Hyatt made a huge jump in year two in this offense. I think for a lot of guys, it just takes that second year to really get a hang of things.
And maybe if you're Chaz Nimrod and Caleb Webb, and they have been here for 2 years already, but they really just got their toes wet last year.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe they're sitting there saying, well, gosh, look at Jalin Hyatt. Look at Dante right now, man. Right. Look at Cedric Tillman. You know, maybe I'm the next guy that can take that huge step.
And
again, it goes about the, you know, culture and everything that, like, a lot of these guys at the time of this recording, you know, Elijah Herring's it has jumped in the portal. I mean, everybody wants to stay here and play.
Yeah. And we'll talk about Elijah in a second here, but I just look at it in terms of Dante and then Mike. That makes sense that grouping is together, because if Dante has a great year, then Dante's gone, and then you have Mike to step right in, and a great guy to learn from. And Mike obviously popped in the spring game, and I think he's going to be a really fun player on the outside for Tennessee. And then you look in the slot, Braylon Staley, who you've talked about, like, has had a great spring, and he just feels like more of that Jalin Hyatt. Just, he's going to be that separator. He's going to be very different than Squirrel. Like, Squirrel was has been more of the Velus Jones slot guy for Tennessee, which is extremely valuable, but he's not the vertical threat that Jalin Hyatt was. He's not the burner, and he's not going to be that guy. He's going to be, like, I wouldn't be surprised if, I don't know if you agree, that Squirrel is still probably going to lead this team in receptions this year. If I had to guess, he's still going to be a big part, but they need more of those game breakers on the outside. They need more of those difference makers. And Dante was really actually coming into his own before he got injured on that touchdown catch on the outside.
On a great adjustment.
Yeah, like, he's going to be good. Like, I would just, all the folks, I would buy as much Dante stock as I can. But the funny thing is, Brew, like, it felt like before the offseason even began, and I wonder if you feel this way, Eric, that, like, Brew has to come back. Where you're like, all right, we have a lot of uncertainty here going into next year. Like, Nico's first year, we need Brew in the fold. We need Brew back. And then you see Chris Brazel in the spring, and Chris Brazel looks really good. Dante's obviously back. You still have Caleb Webb and Chaz Nimrod. You have these freshmen who are popping a little bit. To me, I'm like, I'm so curious who starts on that opposite side. Because right now, my gut is Dante and Squirrel, if they're healthy, are occupying two of those spots. like Chris Brazel, do you rotate? Maybe it makes it easier to bring Brew back because you have these options like Caleb Webb, like Chaz Nimrod, like Chris Brazel. And what we just talked about with Dante is like Brazel can pop right now, but if his plan is, and you can sell these guys of like, we'll get your feet wet, like Chaz Nimrod and Caleb Webb got last year, and Dante for a little bit as well. And then year two is where it's going to pop. Like, just stay with us, Chris. And then next year is the year that you really break out. But Brew is going to be the guy. I'm so curious how that side goes, because I feel like it's kind of solidified in the other two. Over there, the competition in fall camp for that final spot. I mean, because Brew is going to miss all this time, and Brew's gets the benefit of the doubt. And we know how good he is in this offense. But there's just so much competition potentially. And we'll see if they enter the portal, if there's any portal movement in that regard. But for right now, man, I am so fascinated by those four guys who are all competing for what seems to be one spot.
Yeah, and I mean, there's been no portal activity there so far. And if and I don't think anybody's expecting it, but like if someone does enter, it wouldn't be shocking just because of all the competition we're talking about. But man, I hope they all stay.
Oh,
because,
yeah.
I mean, just what a group. And it speaks more to like, and I mean, right now, I would expect all of them to stay. I'm just saying, you just never know in today's era.
Yeah.
If they all do stay, it just says, okay, I want to be here. I want to work. I want to compete. Mm-hmm. I want to be better than this guy. Like, I'm not going to run from this. And so, like, that as a fan and, you know, as a football guy, that just speaks so much to me. So,
yeah.
With Chris, I'll say this, Chris Brazel, I went to the airport when he came in for his visit and, you know, got an interview with him. And I remember one of the big things he stressed was, and of course, he wants to come in and ball out year one. Everybody does. But he did say, hey, Nico's going to be here for multiple years. Like, I can have him for multiple years. So, like, I remember him saying that then. I'm like, okay, he's thinking big picture. Like, not just this year. Obviously, not draft eligible, but, like, next year. And he's still going to have that quarterback. So, I think that's something that kind of goes into you're going to play. Get your feet wet. We'll see what happens. But don't worry. You're still going to have another year to ball out in this offense. As for Brew, man, I'm with you. You got so many different options. And Brew's kind of an afterthought right now because he's injured, not been in spring practice. I think Brazel and Thornton are much more, like, the potential is so much higher for them compared to a guy like Brew, who was a former five-star in himself.
Yeah.
But what Brew brings is just consistent route running. He knows this offense, and Tennessee fans will love this. He's just got that dog in him. MRI got the dog in him. Like, literally, like, he loves and embraces physicality, and Tennessee loves.
He's a great blocker.
Receivers that go block, and it's a big part of this, and that's what he does. So, yeah, we'll see. I mean, I think a healthy Brew, and they can certainly afford to ease him back into things because they have all these options. But a healthy Brew is going to start because he's the alpha in the room. Mm-hmm. Squirrel will start. And then I'm with you. I think Dante will be on the other side, but you know, Brew get a sip of water. Here's Brazel. You know, Dante goes out, touchdown. Okay, here's, you know, Webb, Matthew, whoever it is.
Yeah.
They just have so many options, which is great for Nico and great for Joey Halsley.
Absolutely. Elijah Herring entered the portal this week. Obviously, the leading tackler for Tennessee last year. I think one of the things, and I've been asked from Georgia people and around, I'm sure you have as well, Eric, about like what this means. And because if you're on the outside and you're not like inundated with daily Tennessee stuff and you're not really plugged in, like that kind of raised an eyebrow, I think, by a lot of people of like, sure, leading tackler, why would he leave? I think this one to me, and I wonder if you share this, is like, I think Elijah came on, he got better. He was thrust into a role. He was like, it was just you were thrown into the fire because of injury with Keenan Peele. Like, the plan was not for Elijah, I'm sure, to be as relied upon, where it's like, all right, man, we got to have you step up. You've got it, like Aaron Carter and Keenan Peele both gone. And that is something that I think Tennessee was not expecting. Aaron Beasley obviously was there to help things a little bit, but that it was just a trial by fire here a little bit for Elijah. And I think a lot of Tennessee fans were, I think, too hard on him, especially early on in his tenure running things for Tennessee at the linebacker spot. But for me, I think it just speaks to just he got those opportunities, he got those reps and was a starter down the stretch. I think it's really hard for guys to then just be like, because Aaron Carter, who's still getting healthy, Keenan Peele comes back, it's hard to go backwards, you know what I mean, and be like, all right, once the toothpaste is out of the tube, like, I've started a lot, like, I'm ready to build off this. And unfortunately for Elijah, I think, but good for Tennessee, is that they have the depth in that room now that they did not have the last few years. So it's like, we can rotate, but like Jeremiah Tealander is gonna be a good player, and clearly they like him a lot in the kind of spring that he's had. Aaron Carter, obviously a big get. There's big expectations for him. You get Keenan Peely back, and I wonder if Keenan, if he doesn't come back for this season, maybe a lot. Like you always wonder, like just who comes and who goes.
For sure.
Right, and I think it's okay. Like I don't think it's like a so for the folks on the outside who are like, why would Elijah leave? It's because there might have been three guys in front of him to start this year, and he's started a lot of games now for Tennessee and played a lot of snaps. That it's hard for a guy to go back to being a rotational guy off the bench when you have showcased being a starter in SEC play. So, I mean, I wish him the best, and I think he'll catch on somewhere and work out. But to me, I just don't look at it as something that's a big deal, because I think Tennessee is pretty sneaky loaded at that spot if they're healthy.
Yeah, you bring up a lot of good points. I mean, first of all, Elijah, great kid, root for him. He was the first prep commit for Josh Heupel as Tennessee's head coach. Jeremiah Crawford technically was the first one that he signed in that February signing class, but Elijah Herring was the first commit for that class of 2022, I guess. He's got limitations. You know, he's an in-the-box player. He is he screams Big Ten to me because there's more tight ends and 21 personnel, and you know, and the game's kind of evolving everywhere, but you know, tight ends or big boy football is still kind of up there in the Big Ten, and so that feels like a good landing spot for him. But
I can also see him at Tech, like doing the reverse Wesley Walker, where he just catches on and he starts at Tech. I could see him being really solid there. I think saw he's like that was something that jumped out to me, where I was like, oh yeah, Tech makes sense. Michigan State, I feels like or Colorado, I think is who he's meeting with this week.
Yeah, he's going to visit there. Yeah, and he got better. It's not like he was bad, and he'll continue to get better. But he's a downhill run stopper in the box guy, and he had some limitations, and he was not, as you mentioned, expected to play 90 snaps a game. So from the outside looking in, you're like, oh, this guy led the team of tackles. You know, why is he leaving? I'm glad you brought up Jeremiah Tealander, because they like him so much. And they think the world of Aaron Carter. He was out there running around with no helmet, doing everything he could in spring, even though he wasn't medically cleared, you know?
Yeah.
He was doing all he could. And you got Keenan Peely, Edwin Spillman's coming up, and guys like Jalen Smith, Jordan Burns. So, yeah, I think this group's going to be loaded and be much better than it was last year. And Elijah Simmons, you know, Elijah Herring, we'll see. You know, he announced he was going to enter the portal before it opened. He did not officially go in until Thursday morning. So won't shock me. I'm not saying this is going to happen, but like if he were to pull his name out and remain at Tennessee, wouldn't shock me. I think he'd be welcome back. His brother's still here, and Caleb Herring. Yeah. That's one to keep an eye on. But if he goes to Colorado or wherever, and you root the best for him, because again, like you said, he got starter reps. Be hard to kind of go backwards. He just wants to play. It's not a money grab. He just wants to play football, and I can't fault him there.
No. Final football thing. Are you buying or selling the Vols need a portal running back? Because I think there is you see in the VolQuest message boards and running back watch is basically what the Journalist Quarterly is right now.
No.
I wonder if we're on the same page here, because I don't think that Tennessee needs a portal running back. I think it sounds better in theory right now, where you're like, you're worried about the depth because Cam Seldon's not there, because Dylan Lewis is not there. I'll believe Heupel's running game struggles when I see it. Like I'm going to need to see proof that Heupel cannot rotate and these light boxes that these running backs are going to be walking into, especially with the talent that Tennessee has on the outside, especially with what Nico is going to do potentially to really exacerbate things for opposing defenses. To me, I'm pretty, it's not like adamantly opposed. I just don't think it's necessary. And like, I think a lot of people saw that Khalifa Keith and Deshaun Bishop did not have they didn't have a big run. They didn't have a big breakout in the spring game. But
they were also running behind guys who are not going to be playing on the offensive line.
Right. And I don't think so. I think even if Cam's not right and you just have to rotate with Dylan Sampson and Khalifa Keith and Deshaun Bishop for those first game or two against it, I just think the holes are going to be there for the most part. I think those guys are going to be more than capable of stepping in. I think Dylan Lewis is going to be a really good player. Obviously, I think Cam Seldon is going to be awesome when he gets back. I just wouldn't rock the boat. And I think I would just lean into the, hey, this is a style of play that they can rotate by committee. I mean, Jalen Wright was not this superstar guy that they brought in. They developed him extremely well, and he became much more of a complete back in his time at Tennessee. My gut says, especially like this late in the process, I would stay away. Like, I don't think they need Damian Martinez. I don't think they need to go big time portal shopping at running back. I think they'll be fine. And I think these guys are more than capable of stepping in while some of the bigger names are sidelined. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with that for the most part. And I'm glad you brought up light boxes, because some people on social media this week don't understand that when you have a light box, you run, and when you have a, you know, eight or nine guys in the box, you throw.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, that's football 101. You know, they really like Peyton Lewis a lot, but he didn't go through spring. So it's like, well, what do you truly have in him? Cam Seldon's going to be out. You know, hopefully he returns 1st of September. Maybe he misses September. We'll see. You are one sprained ankle. You are one big hit away from being in some serious trouble, in my opinion, a running back. So I get the concern. Like, I 100% get it. The hope is you can mask all that for the first couple weeks of the season before Seldon gets back and you have a healthy offensive line. But, you know, Dylan Sampson, the reason Jalen Wright took a huge step last year is because for probably the first time in his career, he went through fall camp. He went through spring practice. He took hits. You know, he wasn't fumbling. Like, he knows what it was. He knows what it feels like. So you want to go into fall camp and protect Dylan Sampson at all costs, but you got to get him ready. And so the threat of him turning an ankle or whatever is super real. So I get it. On the flip side of that, man, I'm not going out and paying $500,000 for a running back to come in and back up Dylan Sampson. I'm not. Like, that's not smart. That's not good business. You know, plus, you know, Dylan Sampson isn't on a name and like to deal with the collective spire. You know, I don't know what he's making, but you're going to go out and get a guy. You're not going to pay him more than you're paying Dylan Sampson. You're not going to do that.
No.
And that's things that we just don't think about, and we're starting to become accustomed to in this era of college football. So if they can find a guy that wouldn't rock the boat, that come in here in depth, sure, go take him, because I do believe that there is a need there. But do I think that's going to happen? Not really, because, again, a lot of these guys in the portal right now have got some price tags on them. And you're just – I mean, it doesn't make sense to pay that much money for a third-string running back. It just doesn't. So we'll see. Maybe a mid-major.
No.
A couple of mid-majors in there right now would make a little bit of sense. We'll see what they do. But overall, I think Tennessee can make do with Peyton Lewis, Deshaun Bishop, Khalifa Keith, along with Dylan Sampson until Cam Seldon gets back.
Yeah, I mean, Jabari Small was awesome. Like, there was a time where Jabari Small was RB1 and Tennessee's offense was top 10 in the country. And that's no, like, offense to Jabari. Like, Jabari was solid in this. Yeah, but Jabari was not, like, Deshaun Bishop can do what Jabari did. Like, theoretically, like, Khalifa Keith can be that simple. So I just think Tennessee fans who panic about that, I'm like, that's not going to be, I understand, like, it's getting really thin depending on how the injuries are going here. I'll believe it when I see it that Tennessee's going to struggle to run the football.
I'm with you, man. Again, they've averaged 200 yards a game on the ground since Heupel's been here. Like, he said, you know, everything we do, it starts with a run. Everything we do, it starts with a run. So I'm with you. We'll see what it looks like. And I'll be intrigued how they play this, because they are evaluating guys in the portal.
Yeah.
But they are, I feel very confident saying they're not going to go out and throw $400,000 to somebody to bring him in. That's just not good business.
No, I would. I don't know if you agree. I mean, this is something we talk about later, but in future pods. But mine is the corner. Like, Cormani McClain popped in, and I saw, like, UCF or USF with Golish was one of the top. And I'm like, that might be one where, now we want to talk about, like, where to spring portal shop. That might be one that I would have circled of, like, you're an injury or two away at the corner spot from being in a lot of trouble to me.
I agree.
And not just with talent, but just with uncertainty.
And you play two at a time, whereas running back, you play one at a time.
Yes. So that one to me, I think if you could add more depth at corner, I think every Tennessee fan would feel better. I feel like that's just a better way of allocating your resources and your budget. In my opinion, it's just like, you can never have enough corners in this sport. And I just think it's younger. It's a lot of turnover in the secondary. And if there is someone who can help you that enters the portal, corner to me makes a lot more sense than just reaching on a running back, just because you're a little bit nervous about your depth there.
I think for sure if Tennessee has a safety leave to the portal or a corner leave to the portal, they will go get one for sure. If one's in there right now, that kind of makes sense, multi-year.
Kamal Haddon was a spring guy, wasn't he?
Kamal Haddon was a summer guy.
Yeah.
So he was at Auburn in the spring and then decommitted or got out of his national letter, whatever it was. And then he showed up at Tennessee over the summer. Same with Brandon Turnage. Both those guys showed up in the summer before 2021. So, yeah,
that's where I would go. I want a Kamal Haddon situation. That's what I would prefer, is a Kamal Haddon or Brandon Turner situation than another running back.
They feel good about their top three at corner, and Jalen McMurray being the third, and, of course, Ricky and Jamar McCoy. They feel good about Andre Turrentine. I mean, none of these guys are perfect, but they feel good about Andre Turrentine, Jacoby Thomas, and Will Brooks. And then so it's like that 3-4-5 range, both at corner and at safety. Yeah, I mean, it's pretty thin. And Jordan Thomas, if Boo Carter comes along and maybe takes that star job, Thomas can slide back and play safety too.
Yeah. I mean, Boo Carter is the ultimate. Like, do you slide him at corner if you get a little thin where you're like, Boo Carter's going to have to play. Like, that's another thing where you just jot down, you're just like, Boo Carter's going to have to play football.
Yeah,
like,
he's going to have to be on the field. He's a dude.
Yeah, like, Boo Carter's going to be, just a star. I'm very excited to watch Boo Carter play. Final thing here before we go. Tennessee, sneaky. I don't think either of us had before the year. Tennessee, Kentucky would be the biggest Tennessee baseball series in the spring, but here we are, and I think it is going to end up being the most important, most interesting series for Tennessee before regional play and all that good stuff. But what are your expectations? We get Stamos back in the Friday night spot. It worked last week to perfection with him and Kazi got back on track in the bullpen. You try out Marcus Phillips in the midweek spot here, so maybe we get some Phillips action this weekend as well. But what are you most intrigued about this series? Because Tennessee, obviously the best part of this game, Tennessee should only we're not doing that. Mizzou and Kentucky, we're not going until April because we need to make sure that it's the temperatures are where we want them, because just go ahead and cancel those out. Like, we don't need to do that anymore. And thankfully, I think the weather's gonna be pretty nice.
It's gonna be chilly though. I mean, it's in typical,
it's not
Tennessee,
bad chilly. It's not what it was 2 years ago. It was cold when Tennessee went to Kentucky and lost that series 2 years
ago. It was 40 and raining in the middle of May.
No, won't be that.
It's going to be like low 60s, high 50s.
That's perfect. Tennessee's won a lot of games that way. I don't want the rain and cold for this Tennessee baseball team.
I think the thing I'm paying attention to is how Tennessee is going to limit the base runners, how Tennessee's going to manage the base runners. Because, and I know you're doing work covering Tennessee baseball as well, you look at Kentucky on paper, and they're a great team.
Yeah.
But and it's why you play the game. But you look at them on paper, so average. Mm-hmm. Extremely average. Like, Georgia's lineup scared me going into that series. I'm like, man, this is a good lineup. Kentucky's lineup is okay.
Yeah.
The arms have been super consistent. They're okay. Nothing's popping. But what Kentucky does do is run. They have stolen 79 bases. The Vanderbilt has stolen. No, Vanderbilt has attempted the second most steals in the conference at 77. That's two less than the bags stolen by Kentucky this year. So they run well. They play small ball. They get on. They bunt guys over. They play small ball. So the battery, holding runners on is going to be really, really important this weekend. So I'm intrigued to see what it looks like, man. But
That's why you feel good that Cal Stark's where he's at, because you can play Cal Stark a bunch this weekend and the bats really come on of late. And he's just playing the best baseball he's played at UT. That, like, Cal is going to be huge this weekend, right? Like, he's an X factor.
I think so, for sure. I mean, and the thing I like about Cal, the bat's starting to come around a little bit. He's never going to hit 300, right? He's getting close right now, but
he doesn't have to do that.
But he works so well with the pitchers, and he's that type of guy. Like, he's got fire. If you ever watch Cal Stark in a game, he is like going at 10, 100 emoji all the time. Even when he wasn't in the game on Tuesday, he's out there like firing up with the pitcher and everything. So, he's a guy you want on your side. He's playing really well right now, but he's going to be big this weekend, trying to control those base runners. It's Tennessee's offense just continues doing what it's doing. It had a little slower weekend against LSU, but the top five in that order is incredible. Dean Curley's still good hitting towards the bottom. Now Cal hitting the way he is towards the bottom. If you can get whoever's in that DH role, Reese Chapman or Dalton Bargo, to give you a little bit as well. I mean, top to bottom, this order is just so dangerous. And just give you a chance on the mound, right? I mean, Stom looked really good in his role last Friday. Kazi bouncing back was incredible. That was great. Drew Beam was vintage Beam, letting everybody in the world on base, but only allowing one unearned run. Yeah. And then Xander just continuing to go out there and press you every Sunday. I like this team. They're fun to root for. They're fun to watch. And they're turning into a really well-rounded ball club. That's not just, like Tennessee football's offense. Like, oh man, they score a lot of runs, a lot of home runs. They're starting to turn into a really well-rounded ball club. And I think if you win this series, I've been like, last couple of weeks I've been saying, number four in the country. Well, I don't think they're that good. You win this series, you are deserving of that number four ranking, in my opinion. And I know they're number two in one poll, but like, they're number three in USA Today and Perfect Game in Baseball America, number four in D1 Baseball. You win this series, you're deserving of that record.
Absolutely. And I mean, and we'll get out on this note. I'm curious, because I wonder if the Stamos thing continues on the Friday spot. We'll see on AJ Russell. I mean, I think at this point I would probably not plan on AJ Russell ever being in the rotation spot the rest of the way this year.
I would
but
agree.
That's asking a lot to stretch him back out and go to that point. But can he be Chase Burns for a playoff run from a year ago? Can he be that just kind of reliable guy that shuts games down and is kind of like a de facto closer that Nate Snead's been at times? And you move Snead, because I wrote about this week where I don't know if Tony and Frank are going to go down this road, because I understand that Nate Snead has been really, really good out of the bullpen, and he's been probably your most reliable arm all year long in that spot. At a certain point, like you just kind of like with regional play, the SEC tournament, to me, I am very, very curious if they make the pivot that like, all right, Snead's got to be one of our three starters. Like he's like, it's nice to have him coming out of the pen and having guys like that out of the pen, but our best three has got to be Snead, Drew, and Xander, and then we let the chips fall where they may with our bullpen, and then hopefully AJ Russell is someone who can be there, and AJ Causey too, where and Aaron Combs. Like I just feel like we're getting closer and closer to like, all right, man, like we gotta put Nate Snead in the rotation.
The fact
somewhere.
That Combs is giving you back to back really, really good outings, yep, gives you more confidence you can do that. The fact that AJ Causey, you know, got back on track last week and gives you, mm-hmm, more confidence you can do that. They're using Andrew Binky. If Marcus Phillips could ever join the party on the weekends, yeah, you would have more confidence. The reason they love Nate Snead where he is because they put him in a 3-1 ball game in the eighth inning, and he was hitting triple digits, and he was pumped with so much adrenaline that LSU couldn't touch him, and Tennessee won the series. That is exactly why Nate Snead is where he is, because he closed the door on a series win on that Saturday against LSU, which is awesome. But as we've seen, man, he's gone six innings a couple of times in long relief. If more guys continue to come on, then I think yes. I mean, especially like in regional play and SEC tournament, like you can get a spot start out of him. He's certainly capable of it, but they love him being kind of the Swiss Army knife. AJ Russell, you're right. He will never be stretched back out. He's not going to throw 80, 90 pitches again this year. Barring a setback, he should be back early to mid-May. Mm-hmm. He started to do a little bit more this week. He's been throwing a little bit more. He was shut down and just completely resting because he had a couple injuries, obviously. When he comes back, you know, hopefully midway through May, they're going to use him in short stints. That could be to open a game. That could be middle relief. That could be to close. Picture that as like, what a September call-up you have if you're Tennessee. If you get AJ Russell in the bullpen to, you know, pitch in whatever role you need him to, just in short stints. And so that's the hope right now. And man, if you get that rolling in towards postseason play, that is just making already a top five team that much more dangerous. And arguably the best pitcher on staff who just hadn't been able to catch a break this year in AJ Russell.
It's a good problem to have, but you got to get everybody healthy. You got to keep in you're running out of time to experiment. And that's the other thing. It's like we're it's go time. And this, I don't know. It's a good problem to have. Tennessee is mashing and they might set the Grand Slam record this year. They're on pace to potentially do that. So, I mean, it's a good time, and it's hard to find a better 1-2-3 order or anywhere in the country than Simo, Burke, and Amak here. So it'll be a fun weekend. It's going to be a fun one for Tennessee fans with Tennessee UK. But Eric, what can the good folks check out from you over at Locked On Vols and FallQuest.com this week?
Yeah, tons of Tennessee baseball coverage. I'll be in Lexington this weekend, so everything you guys need to know over there at VolQuest.com. Got the Porch Podcast up at VolQuest.com with VFL Luke Lipsius. It's up right now. And everything else on Locked On Vols and, of course, VolQuest.com. Anything Tennessee-related, you can get it there, and follow me on Twitter at _Kaner.
There we go. Eric, thank you as always. Have fun this weekend, and I'll talk to you very soon.
Happy birthday, buddy. Appreciate you having me on.
Thanks,
buddy.
All right, we're back here on the Chase Thomas Podcast, where I'm now joined by a first-timer from Fish on First. Unfortunately, there have not been a lot of fish on First because, oh my goodness, what a start to the year for the Miami Marlins. But maybe they'll get some more players on first base. Who knows? But as a Braves fan, I kind of don't want that to be the case. So in the interest of full disclosure, it's not the worst thing on my end. But unfortunately for folks like Eli Sussman here and the good folks over there at Fish on First, man, what a start here, Eli. I mean, I've been wanting to talk fish here for a couple weeks now, and I wanted to go to the source, someone who is locked in to what is going on with the Miami Marlins. But first things first, how are you doing, sir?
I'm doing all right overall. To be honest, it gets tiresome to the same storyline again and again and again. There's only so many times you can tell the fans themselves how awful things are, mm-hmm, and how much they're suffering. But to be honest, it is a little rejuvenating to retell what's going on to new people outside from people, as you said, with a different perspective, one that you probably don't mind this whatsoever from the Braves mm-hmm. angle. So I am excited to come on and get you up to speed on what's going on here.
Yeah, and it's funny. So John Taylor, formerly of Fangraphs, and I, we do our MLB show every week, and we were talking last night. Like, I couldn't imagine being a White Sox podcaster at this point. Like, I don't know what you do, like, signing up. I mean, there were, like, 12 people there yesterday for a doubleheader, and it's just, you have to create the content. You have to just get in there. The Marlins aren't that way. This is what's so weird, is the Marlins had wildcard aspirations. This is not a White Sox, Oakland A's situation where it was like, it was doom and gloom before the year. We knew it was going to be doom and gloom during the year. You got to know what you signed up for. With Miami, I was like, yeah, they could easily be a wild card team. They could easily be a really solid team. I like a lot of guys in this lineup. I love their pitching staff. There's a lot to, I think they have opportunity to make some more moves to bolster this lineup with some pitching trades. Like, there wasn't stuff when I looked at this and I was like, they could have one of the, their season could be over in mid-April. I didn't have that on my bingo card. So Eli, explain to me what happened here to get the Marlins off to such a terrible start that set them back so far, and how much of it was something that you saw before the year? Is like, I could see maybe this kind of storyline or this kind of issue popping up, or how much it was just bad luck. The baseball gods just were not kind to Miami for the first month of the season.
There are roughly 15 people involved with Fish on First, including myself, and 14 of us predicted the Marlins would be worse this year than last year. There was one that said maybe they'll be exactly the same. That was a very optimistic angle. It was a really disorienting offseason because they made the change at the top with their GM, Kim Eng, going out, replaced by president of baseball operations, Peter Bendix. And he was like, in equal parts, it was really chaotic, and at other parts it was just stagnant as well. They just did so little to improve this team whatsoever. The few additions they made were guys coming off of very bad seasons and just counting on them to maybe bounce back, but otherwise just the lack of urgency to make any sort of additions for a team last year that, even though it was successful, it had really glaring holes. It had terrible production at catcher. It had terrible production at shortstop. It benefited from lucky, I would say, production from its bullpen last year, and just about everything that has gone wrong everything that could go wrong has gone wrong in terms of injuries to some key guys that they couldn't afford to lose. The bullpen, as I mentioned, going from a really clutch bullpen last year to being the least clutch bullpen in baseball so far this year. That is always going to swing close games for you if it happens. Defensively, about as bad as any team in baseball. I think that was something that I did foresee, and I think it was fairly plain to see, is that they were not going to be very good at making outs on balls in play. And when you have guys next to each other that all have deficiencies in that area, it really compounds on top of itself, and it makes the pitcher seem a lot worse than they actually are. And then, yeah, offensively, almost everybody is underperforming a little bit, and they finally have now had an injury to one guy they couldn't afford to lose in Jake Berger. Yeah. So he's going to be out even through the upcoming Braves series that these teams face off next week. So it's been a little bit of everything. They're not quite as bad as they appear right now, but it is really incredible that so early in the year, this looks like a team that is out of it, even if things to regress to the mean. There are so many holes, and I don't think the front office is really motivated to plug those holes in the short term. They have eyes on long-term sustainability, and that's what's kind of frustrating coming off the year that they just had.
There should be a rule. Every team in like the state cannot have the same operating principle. So when you bring in the Rays guys, it's like, no, like that was kind of the fun part about Jeter and Kim was like, oh, there, maybe Miami can operate with a little bit bigger budget. Maybe they can be a little bit more aggressive, and like the Giancarlo Stanton type stuff is not going to be out of the ordinary. And maybe that they will be a little bit more interesting here year in, year out. But then they go the other way, and now you have two Tampa Bay Rays type teams operating in there. So when they made that switch, did that concern you, or did you look at it as like, well, you know, there's a lot of, I mean, it's just one of those things when you bring in somebody from Tampa, you hope it's Andrew Friedman, but it's also could be Chaim Bloom. Chaim Bloom was a disaster in Boston. I mean, Chaim Bloom, John and I, who's a Red Sox guy, we were going through it. Like, there's no hits really for Heimblum. Like, it's kind of unbelievable just how bad his tenure was in Boston. I think it's one of those should be studied by baseball historians about every trade and like just how he looked at talent and I mean how much he set that franchise back in a multitude of ways. So it's like you assumed coming in like, oh, this is going to be a nice hire. Like, we're going to we're bringing in somebody from the Rays. So you bring in a Rays guy with money theoretically to spend in Boston. You're like, this should be a great combination. And it was a disaster. Miami, you bring in a Rays guy. I mean, you kind of felt like you were kind of going this way anyway. And I see it feels like that's probably part of why Kim and this ownership group did not work long term, is there's probably a difference of opinion on how to team build and how to go about this. Is that kind of just, is it kind of what you've been expecting and what Marlins fans have been expecting, that you were going to go down this rabbit hole once Jeter left and then Kim left this offseason?
The really justified criticism of Kim Ng is that the farm system had totally crumbled under her watch. Mm. And she had made some really aggressive trades last year that, while they were fun in the moment, they were wildly imbalanced, and it left them in a situation entering this offseason where it's one of the weakest farm systems in baseball in terms of guys.
So which ones did you not like that she made last year? Which one are you talking about specifically?
The one that was really stood out was the David Robertson acquisition, taking on his money and still somehow having to give up two of their better like teenage hitters in their organization, including one in Marco Vargas that I think could really relatively soon be one of these more nationally recognized prospects in there. These are guys that even if they weren't going to help the team immediately, they were, you really could have used them either this offseason or in the future to address other needs. And now they just have so few of those guys that even project to be anything close to everyday players in major leagues right now. So there was clearly something going wrong with how they were developing hitters, and then the eagerness to trade some of those guys all in kind of one swoop over the year. Over the course of last year, it really took a big toll on them. The way that you can overcome that is if you have some money to spend on established players. And that has been, as much as people can point at the change in Peter Bendix and say, oh, this is him doing this, it really goes even higher to their owner, Bruce Sherman. He touted about how their attendance went up from being the worst in baseball to the second worst in baseball last year. There were people that came out. There was like more of an investment from the fans. They pretty recently renegotiated their local TV deal that made it a lot more like competitive than it had been in previous years. Like, in when you include all that with the revenue sharing money that Miami gets as being a small market by baseball standards, like there should have been room in order to make some sort of acquisitions to keep this going. And if there wasn't going to be, the other thing, we just wrote about this actually on our site earlier today, if they were going to go down this rebuild road, they probably should have pulled off the Band-Aid this past offseason and done it immediately, because now they have guys that I think all their value is pretty rapidly diminishing, from Luis Arraez to their closer Tanner Scott, who was coming off a shocking year and all of a sudden has turned back into a pumpkin, and even Jesus Luzardo, who as of we're talking right now, he's been one of the worst starters in baseball, and that probably turns around, but if it doesn't, then they're really screwed in that regard. So in terms of the guys that could actually revitalize their farm system very quickly, now it's really an anxious period between now and the trade deadline to see if those guys can actually snap back into shape. Otherwise, they're kind of in a situation where they were going back to the start of the Bruce Sherman era, 2017 into 2018, where they traded all those stars and they actually did not get much back at all in those trades. That's kind of the concern, that this could be a long process in order to turn things around.
And it's also like one of those, so when you think about Sherman to this point, and I think this is just part of the deal as a fan, now you have to kind of look at this, because like the A's, the White Sox, you're like, yeah, you can make changes at GM, you can make changes, but like if the ownership is the ownership, you're kind of stuck. Right. Does it feel like to you Sherman can be better, that Sherman is hiring well now, that Sherman is committed when there comes a time to really put all your chips in and to go for it? Does he strike you as someone who will pivot that way? Or do you think the Marlins do have an ownership problem long term here?
The one thing you can give him some credit for is that he is increasing the investment in the front office infrastructure, where he has, I've hired all these people under Peter Bendix into positions that did not exist with the front office. They have four different assistant GMs right now.
Okay.
They have a new director of special projects. They have a new director of baseball operations, which is in between Peter Bendix and some of their other roles. They've added a lot more brain power from other organizations, not only the Tampa Bay Rays, but from the Texas Rangers and the Yankees and the Astros and the White Sox. And they have really done what seems to be a really thorough search. And actually, even if these people cost a fraction of what actual players cost, these are, if you bring in more brain power in increasing the size of this baseball ops department to catch up more with others around the league, then that's kind of potentially how you can have the success that the Rays have had. For whatever reason, Sherman was not eager to make those type of hires in previous years. And so now they have more people in there to exchange ideas and get on the right track in that regard. But it is troubling how pretty direct Sherman has been about wanting to replicate the Rays in all facets, including keeping the payroll kind of limited. So I don't have a lot of confidence that they're ever going to spend what they should be proportional to the revenue they make and the revenue that they share from other teams. But I guess I see some sort of vision here where he understands he needs to spend on the behind the scenes infrastructure stuff in order to give them a chance to actually, execute this stuff.
Have there been early positives for the team? Has there been guys that have popped for you that have been like, oh, I didn't see that coming. This has been nice. Like who for the Marlins has been the optimistic? So when you do dive in and you're covering the teams and you're writing and jotting stuff down, who are the positives right now for the Marlins?
Jeez, you really have to go on the pitching side. There have been a couple dating back to spring training. Ryan Weathers was somebody that I had circled that had some breakout potential. He came to spring training throwing harder with a new pitch, a new two-seamer, and with better commands. And as of we're speaking, the most recent start he had was really pretty electric, where a 10 strikeout game. It was probably the best start of his career to this point for a guy that entered this season with a 6 ERA in his career. There are some tangible improvements there. He's a former first round pick who's still only 24 years old. That's a guy that I think has really lived up to the hype that he had coming into spring training. He looks like a guy that could stick in their rotation even when everybody is healthy. And that is a whole lot more than he was valued at when they acquired him. The trade deadline, their bullpen has been such a disaster, but I guess the best guy by default has been Brian Hoeing, who he's a failed starter, but as a reliever now, all of a sudden he's become, I think, a really good setup. He's at this point, he's their best reliever, but ideally he's a seventh inning guy that gets a ton of ground balls, that is a really nasty sinker that can steal him some more strikeouts than you would expect. So he's somebody that at least he's a lot better than I thought he would be. But, on the position player side, there is just absolutely nothing whatsoever to actually feel good about in here. And
one through nine.
No, there have been guys that in AAA have lit it up, and then you come to the big leagues and you see, and maybe this Otto Lopez is now their utility player after putting up he hit 600 in AAA with a 1500 OPS. That's amazing. I don't think it's real, but he earned his chance to come up to the big leagues right now. But I guess Brian De La Cruz is somebody that I circled as a big regression candidate for this year. I thought he was a sell high candidate this past offseason. After last year, he was our Iron Man. He played every single game in left field. And he, after getting off to a slow start, he has been very good recently over the last week and a half, where he has multi hits in 5 out of his last 7 games. He's a talented overall hitter, but there are other flaws in his game that I think hold him back from being somebody that really wants in the middle of your order and playing every day. But Brian De La Cruz he's a fun guy to watch when he's hot, and he was hot for a good stretch of the first half of last year. So I guess it's encouraging to see that he retained some of the stuff that he showed last year. to give him a chance that he can actually be something close to an everyday player moving forward.
I mean, he's your leader in WRC plus, and it's at 104. League average is 100, man. You have two guys over league average WRC plus right now. That's insane. That's insane, Eli.
I think that's better than it was a few days ago. They have kind of fluctuated up and down that 100 mark, him and Nick Gordon.
Yeah.
But Jake Berger, and it has his moments where he was leading the National League in RBIs for a moment before he got hurt. And now before that, he went back into a slump. It's just they did lose their hitting coach over the offseason as well. And that was kind of a bizarre moment right there, because they weren't a good hitting team last year, but yet their hitting coach, Brant Brown, in 2023, he was super respected. And from being able to talk to him, he's somebody that just put in a ton of preparation to at least get the best out of guys. And since he left, they kind of filled that void internally. And Skip Schumacher expressed some confidence that they all speak the same language, that they wouldn't really miss him all that much. They'd be able to do their thing right there. But it is, it's just a really fundamentally bad offensive team. And it's one that just doesn't have a ton of talent. And I mean, that just goes back to their offseason, where I think it was pretty clear they needed to make upgrades on the position player side. And they did just barely anything in that regard to give them a chance to improve upon last year.
We haven't talked about Josh Chisholm, though. I mean, not a great start for him. I don't think he's going to be hanging out with Miguel Rojas anytime soon. And I don't think they're going to grab coffee and catch up anytime soon. But what's still realistic about his future and what he can be? He's only 26 years old still. He's now in a crossroads with the Marlins, it seems like. Because like you talked about, the Marlins, the farm system needs to be rebuilt. You have a 2.4% chance of making the playoffs per Fangraphs right now. It seems like that's out of the question now based on this start. Like, what do you do with Jazz? Do you hope he goes on a heater this summer and that you can sell high and trade Jazz for something interesting? You hope AJ Preller comes calling, because AJ Preller, he just adds another guy like that. I could just see him just being like, we'll figure out a spot for him. We'll put him in some position, because he loves adding shortstops and putting him in different positions. But what do you think is the long-term aspect? I mean, is there a marketing aspect to Jazz where you're like, you don't want to move on from him? Because, I mean, he is well-known. He has a fun personality. He's someone you want to be careful about moving, and like what attendance looks like post-Jazz Chisholm. Like, what do you think ultimately happens here?
He is, as you noted at the end, he is extremely marketable, both nationally and among Marlins fans themselves. They like him a lot. He is not the reason for this awful start to the season. He's been particularly defensively, he's been great. His transition to center field has been, in my eyes, very successful, and that looks legit.
Yeah.
And the fact that moving forward, you could either keep him there or move him back to second base. I think shortstop is out of the equation, but he's somebody that for the long haul, I think he's actually, to me, a safe player because of the amazing quick hands that he has and the power he generates and that flexibility, his base running value. Like when he's on the field, he's going to be good. There are still some pretty big questions about him as an overall player. He can't hit left-handed pitching. And the start of this year has been more the same in that regard. So the overall numbers are kind of limited. There's always going to be some swing and miss. So I think the idea, he's had one all-star appearance in his career. I don't think it's inevitable that he ever gets back to being an all-star, despite being he has all-star vibes, but I don't think he's actually going to be in a future all-star selection. He's somebody that's just a comfortably above average player when he's on the field. So far, he's been healthy. Well, as I say that, he's even dealing with a nagging injury this year, even though he's played almost every game. He now has a little shoulder issue. So that durability has been kind of the unanswerable thing, because it's been so many different injuries during his career, to his knee, to his back, to his foot, to his hamstring. I think I'm missing a couple in there now, the shoulder. So that has to be baked into the equation. I think he is a very logical extension candidate if he actually is realistic about what his price is at this point. He's not like one of these $200 million candidates that all of a sudden across the league that has become more the norm to get high nine-figure extensions. he's somebody that has enough holes in his game that it would have to be a lower number than that. But he's a good part for a team that has just so little in their pipeline right now. And because he is so young and he does like, by all accounts, this new clubhouse without Miguel Rojas, and he likes living in South Florida. Like, I think it is a reasonable fit there, but it's all about what the price is. The Marlins took him to an arbitration hearing this past offseason over a couple $100,000. That is not a great sign if you can't even agree on an arbitration settlement for his first time through the process. Yeah, I think the most likely, because of how long this process could take, I think he is going to get traded within the next 15 months between now and the 2025 trade deadline, if I had to guess. I think they will try to iron out some sort of extension, and it's really about him being able to recognize and be realistic about what's still missing from his game. And if they somehow are able to align on a long-term deal that is not a crazy risk for a team in this position, then I think there's still a chance that he is a Marlin for the best years of his career.
I love it. Eli, what can the good folks check out from you and the team over at Fish on First this week?
A whole lot of stuff. We're just a few hours. Every single series, we do a live preview show on, on YouTube and Twitter and Facebook and on our site directly. We're at almost every single game. The Marlins are in Wrigley Field these next few days, and we have somebody on site reporting from it. We take a lot of pride in that. Almost every single game, we try to have a person on site, but definitely for the home games and a lot of the road trips as well. And unfortunately this year, leaning pretty heavily into the prospect coverage as well, considering that is kind of where this future of the organization is headed. But fishonfirst.com is where you'll find everything as well. And I'm kind of behind the scenes on all the social accounts, Fish on First, wherever you find stuff. In an era where very few people have the dedication to stick with this Marlins team through thick and thin, but we absolutely are an exception to that. So yes, just stay along with us for this crazy ride if you're interested in the team.
I love it. Well, keep up the great work, sir. I'm excited to see what ultimately unfolds here. It's going to be an interesting summer, I think, for the Marlins in a lot of ways. And it would be interesting to see some Braves-Marlins series and all that good stuff. But Eli, this has been a pleasure. I appreciate you making the time today, and we'll have to check back in again soon.
Thanks, James.
Nicely done, nephew. Chase Thomas Podcast. Hell yeah.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Bowl and Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Bowl and Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bowlandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.